You may remember this 2010 incident from Aviation Herald's great reporting, which led to international attention to the case. I wrote about Aviation Herald's work on fear of landing in a piece called 83 Feet Above the Sea at Night and No Investigation. Initially, the Norwegian authorities dismissed the idea that the incident required official attention. Only after significant pressure from Aviation Herald did the Accident Investigation Board Norway, known as the AIBN, conduct a full review of this event and release a report of their findings. Now, the Aviation Herald has documented this very thoroughly, including the fact that the preliminary report was not quite the same in English as it is in the original Norwegian. If you're interested in more information about the investigation and the reports, I highly recommend reading Aviation Herald's coverage, especially Aviation Herald's exchange with the AIBN on their final report. This is on Aviation Herald as Incident Widerøe DH-8A at Svolvær, 2nd of December 2010. But what I want to do here is to focus on the cockpit resource management aspects of this case, where the two pilots have very different perspectives on what happened that night and what level of response was necessary. Specifically, the captain felt, and still feels, that the first officer had overreacted, increasing power for a steep climb after the situation was already under control. The first officer felt, and still feels, that the captain was not responding to the situation, and an abrupt intervention was necessary in order to keep the aircraft from crashing into the sea. The Accident Investigation Board Norway published their final report in November 2016. This was 6 years after the actual incident, which took place in December 2010. The report starts with the AIBN explaining why so much time had passed between the incident and the investigation. Quote, "The Accident Investigation Board Norway was only made aware of the incident in December 2012, 2 years after it had taken place. AIBN assessed the existing information and collected further information. After an evaluation, AIBN concluded in June 2013 that the occurrence was to be considered an aviation incident. An investigation was not opened. In February 2015, the incident was subject to significant attention, and AIBN found that the incident could contain a greater learning potential than first assumed. The decision not to investigate was changed. AIBN initiated an investigation in mid-March 2015. Following initial investigations, the Accident Investigation Board reclassified the case as a serious aviation incident." End quote. The significant attention is, of course, a reference to the Aviation Herald piece outlining the incident and questioning why it had not been deemed worthy of an investigation. For the sake of our analysis, the important point is that the flight crew were interviewed 5 years after the event and expected to recall the details of an incident that lasted just over 10 seconds. However, the notes from the initial assessment were available to the investigation, including the flight data recorder data and the detailed weather reports, without which the investigation could not have taken place. The passenger flight departed Bode on the 2nd of December 2010. The operator was Widerøe's Flyveselskap AS. I do apologize for my Norwegian pronunciation. This is Norway's oldest airline and, according to their website, the largest regional airline in the Nordic area, with a fleet of 40 Bombardier-8 aircrafts and 3 Embraer E-jets. The airline's main base is in Bode. Both flight crew had earlier flights that day. The captain had a 40-minute flight to Narvik and then back. He rested in the lounge for an hour when he arrived back at Bode. The first officer, who had been on standby, was called out for a 25-minute flight from Bode to Svolvær and back again. He arrived back at Bode just as the captain was finishing his break. They conducted a pre-flight briefing together, including an assessment of the weather. Svalbard Airport was showing wind at 30 knots, gusting up to 44 knots, with rain and hail showers and cumulonimbus clouds in the area, which can represent thunderstorms. The visibility was 8 kilometers. The forecast looked like the wind and turbulence might be improving, so the crew decided that they would fly to Svalbard and see how the weather was on arrival. The aircraft that night was a Bombardier DHC-8-103, registered in Norway as Lima November Whiskey India Uniform. In addition to the two flight crew, there was one cabin crew and 35 passengers on board. The captain was the pilot flying, and the first officer was the pilot monitoring. Their destination, Svalbard Airport, is designated Class C, the most demanding category of airport, with special requirements for operators wishing to fly in and out. Svalbard is surrounded by mountainous terrain, and the runway is oriented north to south, 01190, and only runway 01 had an instrument approach. At the time, and possibly still, runway 19 was 776 meters, 2,545 feet, with an upward slope of 1.5% just past the center. On fear of landing, you can see a photo of the airport, courtesy of Avinor. The AIP Norway lists the following warning for Svalbard. Wind shear vortexes can occur in the last part of the final approach to runway 19 at wind sector southwest-northwest greater than 25 knots. Inbound pilots often circle at Svalbard, coming around to the other side to land to the south. Videre, the operators say that this happens more often than the wind conditions warrant. The investigation confirmed this, concluding that even when there's no wind at all, pilots still preferred to circle to the south, since the upward slope of the runway gave them the shortest stopping distance. Videre's airport briefing lists a number of risk factors associated with Svalbard Airport, including weather, turbulence, mountain terrain, special procedures for missed approach, and the risk of a black hole effect. The black hole effect, sometimes called the featureless terrain illusion, is a known optical illusion that takes hold of pilots during night visual approaches, where the runway is in sight but no other ground lights can be seen between the aircraft and the runway. The pilot or pilots become convinced that they are higher than they are and fly a much lower approach than is necessary. The sun had already set when the Dash 8 flew the approach to runway 19. The skies were dark and rainy, with gale-force winds at Svalbard. The archived weather data showed substantial turbulent kinetic energy in the area, which from a meteorological point of view means intense turbulence and wind shear. Wind measurements taken at Svalbard's runway were in line with the weather data. That said, the equipment wasn't capable of showing wind shear, only predicting that it might be likely. The Aerodrome Flight Information Service doesn't automatically offer detailed wind reporting. On final approach, the pilot is expected to request further wind checks or ask for continuous wind readings if they feel it is necessary. The AFIS duty officer offered the current wind reading while the aircraft was downwind, but didn't volunteer any further information. There are standard procedures for an approach with risk of wind shear, but the flight crew didn't follow them, presumably because they didn't realize that's what they were flying into. The aircraft did not have the capability of detecting wind shear, and the warning in the company briefing was for the last part of the final approach, which they had not yet reached. Both pilots remember the weather, and that as they were approaching Svalbard, the wind dropped to about 10 to 12 knots, well within operational limits. They started the instrument approach, following the standard procedure for southwesterly winds. This procedure is to approach northward, lock 01, down to the minimum descent altitude of 580 feet. At that point, if the aircraft is clear of cloud and the crew has good visibility, they can perform a visual circle east of the airport and position to land on runway 19. There is an image of the precision circling runway 19 procedure on fear of landing. Videre has a special permit from the Civil Aviation Authority Norway, which allows them to use precision circling. The report explains this. Quote, "This means, among other things, that one accepts a smaller extent of the obstacle-free area compared with what is the ICAO standard for this category of aircraft. This allows a lower minimum altitude for circling. A number of trade-offs and risk assessments form the basis. For example, it is desirable to get so close to the airport during circling that the likelihood of losing visual references is reduced. One will also want, insofar as possible, to avoid having to make a descent based on visual references, since that makes it difficult to maintain the correct energy on the aircraft throughout the circling. The objective is to avoid ending up too high on the short final approach." End quote. At Svolvær, the minimum altitude was 580 feet. The Dash 8 cleared the clouds well before this, and the flight crew had the airport lights in sight. They descended to 600 feet and continued as planned with a visual circle above the fjord. The roles of the flight crew are clearly defined. As they circle, the pilot flying, in this case the captain, looks out and flies the aircraft based on visual references. The pilot monitoring, the first officer, focuses on the instruments and calls out any deviation from the planned speed, which is 110 knots, or from the flight path. The flight crew prepared for landing on the downwind leg, lowering the landing gear and setting the flaps to 15 degrees. The captain knew that the wind would be pushing the aircraft away from the airport and towards the mountains, which were marked with white flashing avoidance lights. The APHIS duty officer agreed to continue giving them wind readings as they approached runway 19. The flight crew did not discuss the Svolvær approach procedures for a risk of wind shear. As they entered the turn towards the final approach, they flew into a severe downdraft. The Dash 8 was forced downwards and lost speed. It's not completely clear what happened next. There are substantial differences in the accounts given by the captain and the first officer, and also some differences between the reports they made at the time and the interviews 4 years later. After the event, Widerøe's flight operations management interviewed the crew about the severe wind shear that they had encountered. At the time, they stated that the crew had done the right thing by interrupting the approach, although the reaction to the incident was seen as somewhat excessive. Severe nose down, significant engine power, acceleration to a high speed in the recovery. However, the flight operations management were happy that the correct actions had been taken and that the crew had regained control. Some of the flight data information was reviewed at the second meeting, after which the captain was asked to submit a more detailed report, which he did. Based on the meetings, Widerøe management decided that this was not a serious aviation incident, and thus there was no need to report it to the Accident Investigation Board. They submitted their reports to the Civil Aviation Authority, who also didn't see any grounds to involve the Accident Investigation Board. The first officer saw things differently. He requested a copy of the plotted flight data parameters. Then he submitted a further report to highlight the serious nature of the incident. That report was not entered into the management system and was never submitted to the Civil Aviation Authority. Widerøe did not see any need to investigate further. 2 years passed, but the first officer never forgot that night. He left Widerøe and gave up his career as a pilot. In December 2012, with nothing left to lose, he contacted the CAA and the Accident Investigation Board directly. The CAA asked the Accident Investigation Board to look into it. The Accident Investigation Board also concluded that it was not necessary to investigate further. Their main issue was that the first officer had waited until he was no longer working at Widerøe to report the incident. They warned Widerøe that there were issues with their reporting policies and that operators needed to ensure that pilots were aware that they could report a case to the authorities if they disagreed on what happened or the severity of the occurrence. It was 2015 when Aviation Herald broke the story, attracting attention to the first officer's concerns. The first officer sent the flight data to Aviation Herald, which certainly seemed to confirm that this was worth an investigation. Amid media pressure, the Norwegian Accident Investigation Board conceded that the incident could contain a greater potential for learning than first assumed. They initiated their investigation, finally, in March 2015. Shortly thereafter, they reclassified the case as a serious aviation incident. In the interview from the second investigation, the captain remembered clearly the first officer calling, "Check speed," and that, in response, he adjusted the engine power, but only marginally, as he didn't believe that their speed had deviated significantly from the targeted 110 knots. He conceded that they had not discussed increasing the airspeed to counter the effects of the strong winds. The captain then disengaged the autopilot and started the base turn. The flaps still needed to be set to 35 degrees on final approach, but other than that, the Dash 8 was configured for landing. He remembers starting the base turn after he had passed the airport. He saw the airport's lights behind him to the left. Approximately 45 degrees, a normal base turn. It was dark, and he couldn't see the sea beneath him or the horizon in the distance. However, he wasn't concerned. The airport lights were visible on the left, and he could see the red lights warning of obstructions a few kilometers north of the airport. He planned to continue at 600 feet until they were lined up with the runway for landing. But, he said, he hadn't quite started the turn when he first noticed something was out of the ordinary. The first officer had called check speed twice, and then suddenly the aircraft began to shake, and there was a sudden drop. The captain said he corrected for this immediately. Although he clearly remembers applying full power, it had no effect. The airspeed continued to drop, and he had the feeling as if the Dash 8 were being sucked or pushed downwards. He pushed the controls forward to prevent stalling. When he pulled back again to climb, the stick shaker activated, warning of an impending stall. He immediately eased up on the climb to build up more speed. At the same time, he saw red obstruction lights in front of him. He glanced at the altimeter, and his recollection is that it showed about 300 feet, or 90 meters. He couldn't remember if he noticed the stick shaker before or after he pushed the controls forward. He knew that they were low. He focused on one of the red lights and kept flat in order to build up speed so he could climb away without risking a stall. He felt that he knew where the terrain was, and he carefully kept the aircraft level so that they could build up speed. He wasn't sure how long he had, quotes, held the aircraft down, end quotes, but he estimated that it was 4 or 5 seconds. Once they had regained a safe airspeed, he started climbing, and he was confident that they would pass over the obstruction marked with red lights at a safe altitude and airspeed. Then, to his surprise, the first officer took control and initiated a steeper climb. The captain saw no need for this. However, they gained enough airspeed and the situation was under control, so he didn't argue it. None of this had come out in the original reports that Widerøe had submitted to the Norwegian Civil Aviation Authority in 2012. These reports, generated as a part of Widerøe's deviation of management system, were based on the captain's description alone and focused on possible overtorque from the missed approach, which was caused by wind shear. The Widerøe reports did not mention how much altitude the aircraft had lost, or that the first officer had taken over the flight controls. Now, it was clear that the first officer had taken control at the same time as the engine power was increased from, quotes, full, approximately 100% torque, to maximum, approximately 120% torque. Finally, 5 years after the event, the Accident Investigation Board Norway interviewed the first officer. He remembers that he was monitoring the instruments and first called out check speed while they were still downwind. He called again after the captain had entered the circling pattern. He said that the captain had not sufficiently corrected for the conditions, and that they needed to get the airspeed up further to be safe. He expected that they would lose altitude in the turn, and that as a part of the requirement for a stabilized approach, they needed to have wings level no later than when they reached 300 feet. As they started that turn for the final approach, he was startled as the controls started shaking. Realizing that the stick shaker had triggered, he was ready to react to the impending stall. To his surprise, the captain didn't react and made no call-outs. Then the aircraft's nose dropped, and he said that he stared straight down into the black sea, with a red light on a small island visible in the dark. He remembers clearly that the captain was holding the stick in a neutral position, as if he had frozen. They might have been as low as 150 to 200 feet above the water, he said. The first officer was pretty sure that he called out, "My controls," as he grabbed the stick and pushed the power levers fully forward, approximately 116%, until the aircraft stopped descending. He had to pull the control column back with both hands with considerable force, and he remembers thinking that there was no way that this could end well. The aircraft eventually started to climb to a safe altitude. It's important to note that the first officer's report of the events leading up to him taking control of the aircraft is very similar to the original statement he made when interviewed by management in 2010, whereas the captain's version has a number of differences. However, that could simply be that it had been a relatively unimportant moment to the captain, who was mostly surprised at the first officer's overreaction, and quite a traumatizing experience for the first officer, who had seconds in which to realize that his captain was not responding and he needed to take control of the aircraft. Although the investigators could see what had happened based on the recorded flight data, they had no way of determining which pilot did what and exactly when. Clearly, the aircraft lost suddenly a significant amount of speed and altitude as a result of wind shear. Now, at one point, the aircraft was just 83 feet or 25 meters above the ground. In an attempt to recover from the wind shear, the aircraft was exposed to high G-forces and the engine torque limits were exceeded. But the flight crew recovered in time and continued to Lakeness Airport, where they landed normally. But did the captain respond correctly and the first officer overreact after the situation was resolved? Or did the captain freeze up, with the first officer's intervention key to the recovery? The final report summarized the differences in the two men's sequence of events as follows. The commander's statement gave full engine power and lowered the nose of the aircraft when airspeed was lost and the aircraft started to shake. The stick shaker activated during the climb and therefore intentionally kept the aircraft down and accelerated at a safe altitude towards a red obstruction light. Airspeed increased and the climb was initiated before the first officer unnecessarily took over the controls. And then there's the first officer's statement. Stick shaker activated and the nose was lowered as a result of external influence without corrective measures being implemented by the commander. Instinctively took over the controls and increased engine power to avert crashing into the sea. But both of those statements were made several years after the incident in question, and this would clearly have an impact on the recollections of the event. As the report says, quote, "It is human nature, in retrospect, to wish one had performed the task well, which may also affect a person's memory over time." And although the flight recorder data shows that the incident lasted just 10 seconds, both pilots and the cabin crew member were sure that it had lasted much longer. The flight recorder data can confirm airspeed, altitude, flight attitude, engine power, and G-loads, but not when the stick shaker was activated or who moved the flight controls. However, the report puts forward one hypothesis that explains how both pilots were telling the truth, at least as they perceived it. The conditions were right for a visual illusion, the black hole illusion, which is known to occur during nighttime approaches at remote locations where isolated lights are the only visual cue. A pilot suffering from this perceptual illusion during the approach will unknowingly fly a dangerously steep descent angle and overestimate their height. The black hole illusion is not pilot error. It's a perceptual limitation of how humans perceive depth and visual angles. Spatial disorientation leading to loss of control is relatively rare, but often fatal. The problem, of course, is that it's rarely possible to prove whether such a shift in perception actually took place. Even in this instance, with a happy ending, there's no real way to know whether the captain was suffering from an illusion which caused him to misinterpret the situation. The AIBN considered the following sequence of events to be likely. The aircraft was exposed to severe wind shear. The captain attempted to recover by applying full power, but the aircraft continued to lose altitude and speed. The stick shaker activated, at which point the captain pushed forward on the control column and then pulled back again to level out. The aircraft accelerated, but the nose was still 14 degrees below the horizon. At this point, the captain was focusing on regaining control of the aircraft and remembers seeing the red light ahead of him, but not the sea below. He believed that the aircraft had started to climb. They were building up speed, and the captain may have perceived the aircraft as climbing, but in all actuality, they were still descending. The first officer realized that the captain wasn't reacting to the continued descent and that they were in danger. At the lowest point, the aircraft was just 83 feet above the water. The first officer was focused on the instruments, and thus he didn't suffer from the visual illusion, which is why the two pilots had such different perceptions of the same event. The first officer took control and applied max power. In the end, said the AIBN, it didn't actually make a difference. The crew cooperation meant that the response to the wind shear event was appropriate. Between the two of them, they saved the day. The airspeed increased, the loss of altitude was halted, and the aircraft climbed away. Quote, there is no doubt that the climb was initiated by the commander, but there is uncertainty as to whether it was he or the first officer who intensified it. If the first officer intervened at time 103.201.3, there is nevertheless no one who knows how the commander would have moved the controls in the following seconds if this had not taken place. This is a fact regardless of whether the commander was experiencing a sensory illusion or not. Unquote. However, the AIBN also admits that it wasn't a foregone conclusion. Quote, AIBN is of the opinion that the joint actions of the crew prevented an accident when the aircraft was exposed to unusually strong wind shear at low altitude. Marginally longer response time and or less resolute application of engine power would probably have resulted in collision with the sea. End quote. It is hard not to read that conclusion as a continued justification as to why they didn't investigate initially. Even though the AIBN was not contacted at the time and only had partial information when they finally heard about the event from the first officer. It is clear that only the continued pressure from Aviation Herald led the AIBN to take a better look. In the process, they found serious issues with Vidara's reporting and a management culture that meant that the first officer did not escalate until he had left Vidara. In addition, the investigation highlighted issues at Svalbard, which could help a future flight crew in similar conditions. The incident clearly required an in-depth analysis, and it's only a shame that the industry had to lose the skills of a good pilot to finally get it. I'm Sylvia Wrigley, and this has been my first attempt at an audio version of an article on fear of landing. Recorded with no special equipment or editing help. Please let me know what you think in the comments, even if it's just never inflict this on us again. Thank you.